Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2002, and this session at Holden is entitled Economic Globalization and Christian Neighbor Love, Moral Crisis and Whispers of Hope. It is presented by Cynthia Molabita, and it is tape number MOC 2002-05. Let's listen in.
I'm Cynthia Molabita, and this is the first in a series of five sessions looking at global economic justice issues in relationship to the call to love neighbor as self. Today will be a sort of overview, a painting the framework for the sessions together. I've called it Moral Crises and Whispers of Hope. To help us remember to hold hope in close proximity with examining deep moral crises. Let us begin with wilderness, the theme of Holden Village for this year. Wilderness is indeed a place of beauty and renewal and tremendous generation and regeneration, as we have been speaking of it in these days at Holden. Wilderness also has other implications, connotations, especially from biblical perspectives, from biblical stories. What are some of the images that come to mind when you think of wilderness in light of the biblical stories with which you're familiar? Just throw out some of them.
Absence of God.
Absence of God. Interesting. Others. Thank you.
40 years.
40 years. Okay.
Lost in the wilderness.
Lost in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Intimacy.
Intimacy. All right.
Jesus going out into the wilderness.
Jesus going out into the wilderness. Thank you.
Mount Sinai.
Mount Sinai. All right. As I pondered wilderness, and to me wilderness has profoundly healing and regenerating connotations, and those have been my experiences in the wilderness, I also pondered the stories of Jesus in the wilderness and the Israelites in the wilderness. And I realized that in the story of Jesus being driven into the wilderness, it was a place of demons. And it was demons that strove to tempt Jesus away from being who he was as a person of God. And when I looked more into wilderness in the story of the Hebrew people going out into the wilderness, I realized that for the Hebrew people, and I read to you from the Anchor Bible Dictionary, the meaning of wilderness in light of the Hebrew people. Wilderness was a desolate or deserted area, the home of wild beasts, of scorpions and serpents, and thirsty ground where there was no water, a place where men and women find themselves bewildered and disoriented. Unquote. A place of wandering then, and fear and lostness, a place of temptation away from trusting in God and being people of God. I read in Psalm 107, I believe it's 107 verse 4, a place where people's souls faint, and then they cry out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers them, shows them the way. That was not a quote, that was a paraphrase in Psalm 107 verse 4, a place where people's souls faint, and they cry out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers them and shows them the way. In this series of five sessions, I would like us to probe a wilderness of that sort. It's a wilderness in which I believe we live, and which I believe we are so tempted by demons. We're tempted by demons almost beyond human power to stand up against them. It's a wilderness in which I understand us to be a people wandering, a people disoriented, a people that will hear God again and trust God again more closely only if we throw ourselves down in prayer and pleading for the capacity to hear and trust and follow God. And secondly, if we use all of our gifts as human people, our intellectual, our emotional gifts, to find a different way. I'm saying to you, I believe we're in a wilderness. And that we, remember C.S. Lewis when he talked about pray as if it was the only thing you could do, and then act. Pray as if, what did he say? Someone, does someone know it? Mm-hmm. Pray as if it was the only resource you had, and act and use your capacities as if that was the only resource you had, and do the both. I believe that we not only wander in that wilderness, but that we are people of a promise, that God will lead us out of that wilderness and will lead us to be more the people that God calls us to be. Now, the wilderness of which I speak is a wilderness of living according to economic ways, practices, policies, institutions, structures that demand us to exploit other people and demand us to exploit the earth. That is the wilderness in which I understand us to be living. I also understand, and you may disagree with me, and please tell me if you do, that we live with a primary moral spiritual call, and that is the call to love God and to love neighbor as self. It strikes me that living in a global economic system that requires us to exploit is an enormous contradiction to living as a people that are called to, above all else except love for God, love neighbor as self. Does anyone experience that contradiction, see it, disagree with it? Where have you known that contradiction in your lives? Am I speaking uncomprehendable words, words that you disagree with? Yes.
We went to the Guild, the Grunewald Guild, a few weeks ago, and our job, we did a collective collage project.
Yes.
On the scripture, which I can't
remember. Feeding of the 5,000.
And so our job was the wilderness, and to collage the wilderness.
Oh.
And so we spent 4 days with this concept. And
collaging the wilderness.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was so interesting to do it in a group because I felt really strongly about what you're talking about in, and television and how we were pulled away from, I'm focused on children.
Yes.
And so the ways that children are in a wilderness and families are in a wilderness and then the globalization piece is also, so it was really interesting.
Thank you. What a fascinating idea also to collage it, to bring it out.
Yeah.
Other comments? Yes. I'm sorry, would you say your name when you speak?
Karen.
Because I find myself, like yesterday, calling everybody yes.
Sorry, yes.
And it just doesn't work. Karen.
My name is Karen.
Okay.
Yeah, I think of things, too, in terms of, you know, we're all trying to make a living and, and pay our rent or mortgage or whatever and make our way in the world. And we may make more money or less money, but we're trying to sort of stay afloat, trying to figure out how much we need to save for retirement, you know, so we don't end up destitute. And so we're trying to find good deals at the grocery store. And so you're looking at the bananas and you're going, boy, that's a good deal. That's 39 cents a pound, you know. But maybe they're, you know, maybe they were gathered via child labor from Ecuador versus the organic bananas that you know came from a good source that you can get at the health food store that are $2 a pound. Those are the sort of daily, you know, food choices that I'm very aware of.
Okay.
You know, and I know Holden has dealt with those, is dealing with those issues in a wonderfully responsible way. But I feel that challenge personally every time I take out my pocketbook of, you know, my little personal needs versus the greater good.
Okay, wonderful example, wonderful example. Let me read to you. Oh, yes, Alex, did you have your hand up?
Two areas that are pet peeves to me, and I have bought into them on a certain level. One is Wall Street, and that's where my pension is, of course.
Okay.
But to see that that golden cap has begun to manifest a lot of its cracks and things that are just reminding people what an illusion that can be, which is tied into globalization as well. Mm-hmm. The other is Christmas time, when we just seem to throw whatever sense of simplicity, decency, resource guarding into the wind, and we just go crazy because of all the dynamics involved in that. So those are two places where I...
Okay. And the contradictions in our personal lives and in the political world around us are very profound, and they're gut-wrenching. When you have children, you know, you are called upon to enter into a consumer world, sometimes for the sake of your kids, that you would never enter into without having them in mind. What we're going to do today is I want to share with you a couple of very brief readings that symbolize to me the magnitude, the profound magnitude of the wilderness in which we walk, as I've been alluding to it. Secondly, I want to share with you and then talk together about a source of incredible and profound hope and power. So in other words, I want to hold the powerlessness of the wilderness and the incredible infinite power of the presence of God living in us and with us and for us in one breath today. Before we do so, a couple of guide signs for entering into when we dare to enter into realities that are brutalizing, and I submit to you that the realities of the global economy are brutalizing. When we dare to enter into those, on behalf of our own faithfulness, I believe we enter into holy ground. I believe we walk on holy ground whenever we dare to see clearly things that are too painful to see, and whenever we claim the power of the promises of God to lead us toward faithfulness. As a sign of that holy ground, we light a candle, and believe me, it is a rare thing to light a candle in Holden Village this week. Given Fire Danger, I do this with permission. And I put it here so that we might simply recall that hope accompanies us whenever we dare to look at the things that must be seen to walk as people of faith. Secondly, I would like a second guidepost. When we discuss realities that are about people very far and very distant from us, as well as people close by, in other words, when we talk about the global economy, we're talking about neighbors who are far and near and distant. We talk with one great handicap, and that is that we, in this room, to a certain extent, do not have with us the voices of people most suffering, most brutalized by the global economy. We don't have them here. One of my principles as a Christian ethicist, when I teach ethics, is one of the first principles in any inquiry is that you listen to the voices of the underside, the voices of the marginalized. To a certain extent, we don't have many of those voices in this room. So let us keep a chair here to remind us that there are people missing from our discussion, and that as we go forth into the world to understand better our role as neighbors in a global economy, that part of our job is to listen to, seek out, and hear voices from the margins. Does that make sense? Are there question marks about that?
You should probably have a few more chairs.
Thank you.
I'll tell you, that's very interesting.
And the third session of an ethics course at the School of Theology and Ministry at Seattle University, I put this out and I had this empty chair there and I had a mug with something to drink by that chair. And in the third session, when I came into the class, the students had lined up a whole row of chairs with different missing voices. And I thought, yes, this is good. Finally, one additional guidepost. Those are two. I am very aware that the claims I make about the globalizing economy are very controversial and controverted claims. Others can argue very well that the very dynamics of economic globalization that I critique, others can argue that they are very positive and good for people. So let me just put out there that I understand it to be controverted. I don't ask you to necessarily agree with me, but I ask you to probe the implications of my claims. Then in the next four sessions, we'll dig more deeply into what those claims are and what some of the different perspectives on them might be. So bear that in mind also. And hopefully we'll enter into some real discussion about different perspectives on the global economy. Differences, different perspectives that I think are here in this room. So those are three guideposts for our discussions. Let me now read to you a couple of statements that to me somewhat symbolize the implications of economic globalization, first for human beings, and secondly for the greater ecological, for other than human creation. These are very, very short statements, so don't worry. This is a statement written by the United Nations Human Development Program, or the United Nations Development Program, which produces a Human Development Report each year. This comes out of 1998. It writes, "Globalization is concentrating power and marginalizing the poor, both countries and people. The reality, according to that program, is staggering." Quote, I quote again, "New estimates show that the world's 225 richest people have a combined wealth equal to the annual income of the poorest 47% of the world's people." Did you hear that? The world's 225 richest have a combined income equal to half of humanity. The richest three people have assets that exceed the combined GDP of the 48 least developed countries. Did you follow that again?
Did you say that again? Say it again.
The world's richest three people have assets that exceed the combined GDP of the 48 least developed countries. Wow. Now, those are symbolic statements. No, they're very real statements, but I read them to symbolize the one impact of globalization, the increasing divide between the rich and the poor. Now,
there's there's 164 nations in the world at this moment, about 164.
I do not
know.
Well,
that's the number. I mean, I want you to know that 48
is a large percent.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Now, another brief statement to speak to the impact of the wilderness in which I am about which I'm talking on the other than human creation. Okay, according to the State of the World report, I'm quoting to you from the State of the World report, I think it's 1999. Quote, "Biodiversity is the basis for our existence. However, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, humanity now finds itself in the midst of a mass extinction, a global evolutionary convulsion with few parallels in the entire history of life. Most estimates are that at least 1,000 species are lost per year. But unlike the dinosaurs, we are not simply the contemporaries of a mass extinction, we are the reason for it. Reversing this trend calls for restructuring the global economy. The fate of our children depends upon it in ways we can barely begin to conceive." And then according to the Development Dictionary, I quote, if all the countries followed successfully the industrialized example, and by the industrialized example is the model of life promoted by economic globalization today, continued growth in the way in which we now know it. Back to the quote, if all the countries followed successfully the industrialized example, 5 or 6 planet Earths would be needed to serve as mines and waste dumps. We now consume in 1 year what it took the Earth 1 million years to store up. In short, end quote, in short, economic growth, the aim and purpose of globalization has collided with the Earth's natural limits. Economic growth, together with population growth, threaten Earth's capacity to regenerate. In the words of Dan McGuire, a Roman Catholic ethicist, if current trends continue, we will not. We are an endangered species. End quote. None of us wants to be doing this. I'm sure no one in this room wants to be doing this. Wants to be living a life that throws toxins so badly into the earth that it threatens Earth's capacity to regenerate. Living according to the demands of a global economy that enables some to be so rich and some to be so poor, and most of us stuck in the middle of that. None of us wants it. I bet every person in this room longs to love neighbor as self. That's the wilderness in which I believe we walk. Now, we talked about this briefly yesterday in the end of a previous series, but let me say it again. I am firmly convicted, as a faith conviction, that the God that we know through Jesus Christ and the Spirit would not call us to things to which God does not empower us. If God calls us in this context today, in this global economy, to love neighbor as self, and if love does mean serving the well-being of neighbor, then somehow we must be empowered that way. And wherein lies that power is a question that sits before us. I want to throw this open to more discussion. I know I'm talking a lot, more than I perhaps normally talk in a session like this, but I want to share with you a few other statements, and they're statements by Martin Luther, and they're statements that I find speak of a source of moral spiritual power for resistance, that is resistance to ways of life that endanger the poor, endanger cultural diversity, and endanger the health of the planet Earth. As I have looked for sources of resistance, one of the things I have done is look into Christian traditions for faith forebearers who have manifest the power to live in resistance to structured domination, systems of domination. Before I read a couple of those statements, throw out to me, tell me the names of faith forebearers that you think of, that you remember, that maybe hold clues, that give hints of the power they found in their relationship with God to resist systemic domination or systemic evil. Who are people that you know of in your traditions?
St. Francis,
all right.
Dorothy Day.
And let me say, not only individuals, but also communities. Communities of people as well as individuals.
Mother Teresa.
Julian of Norwich.
Woo!
Mm-hmm.
Gandhi. Mm-hmm.
Jesus,
okay, spanning right our traditions, thank you. Any others that come to mind?
Larsh.
Pardon?
Larsh.
Oh, the Larsh community. Yeah. Yes, thank you. I appreciate that comment, partly because I find it so easy for us to think of great figures in the faith, and we forget that all of those figures were situated in communities. Francis was situated in his community. Jesus was situated in his community. As I read the Gospel of Mark, I notice that, and I know we have a New Testament scholar around here, so she may contradict me, but I read that as Jesus' community starts to not be as present with him, his power of doing miracles diminishes. Jesus, too, was situated in a community that was empowering. Those are all good examples. Others that come to mind that haven't been heard.
I don't know the names of all of them. There are a number of intentional communities that exist.
Okay, today.
And some of which are faith-based and some of which are not.
Okay. But those too are forebearers or contemporaries. We have contemporaries and we have forebearers in the faith. It is my conviction that we live in... Let me tell you a little story. Has anyone seen the movie Weapons of the Spirit? Weapons of the Spirit is a video. It's a movie that describes the life of a village in France, La Chambon, but I don't speak French, so I didn't say it right, that a Huguenot village, a Protestant village of Huguenot heritage, that resisted Hitler, that resisted fascism in France, by harboring Jews, a village of 4,000 people that saved the lives of 4,000 Jews. A young man, a baby in that village, a Jewish boy who had been saved as a baby, came back as an adult to inquire why did this small village decide in the midst of fascist France and fascist Germany to risk their lives, and they risked worse than death. They risked being taken and put in concentration camps and dying there, to save Jews. So he went back and he did a film. And as the stories unravel, you begin to question, and I've asked my students to question, what gave this village the moral power to do this? It was a Protestant village led by the pastor and the teacher. And at the very end of the movie, the Jewish man asks one of the old women, there are not a lot of people left that lived in the village, many have died. This is an old woman, kind of hunched over, she has one of those little scarves on her head. And he said, why did you do this? Why did you take these risks? And she looked at him with a kind of puzzled face, and she said, well, what else would we have done? Now, I thought, what enabled that? That's what I refer to as moral spiritual power. And one of the things that enabled it is that people was situated in a heritage of resistance. They were Huguenots. They had lived, they understood their ancestors to be resistors. We saw pictures of their worship service even today, and they were singing the songs of their ancestors, which were songs of Christian resistance. There was a picture of one of the Huguenot women, of a painting, a drawing of one of the Huguenot women who had been imprisoned in one of those prison towers in France under the when they were persecuted. And she had been either released or the prison had been opened and she was found dead after many years. I don't remember which. But scrawled into the wall, scrawled in with her fingernail, was the word resistance. So when I'm digressing greatly from my plan, but I simply am saying that we live as the descendants of people who resisted evil, grounded in their faith. And I don't think we claim and teach and live in those stories as much as we could. And therefore, we fail to claim the power that being the descendants of those people could give us. They could be our teachers. How many people in this room have been taught as a Christian, like in Sunday school and confirmation, etc., that you stand in the heritage of people who resisted evil as a part of their faith? Have you?
Yeah.
Interesting. How so?
It exudes many, many things. I mean, and for me, I think it was just part of my growing up, too.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm hard-pressed now
to
give an example, but
no.
It...
And that's illustrative also, because that speaks to the fact that moral formation is almost organic. sometimes. And by osmosis or by some things that you can't define, you came to see yourself in that position.
Yes. I think, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I don't know very much about him except for what pastors have quoted him over and over again in their sermons. Okay. I know he resisted somewhere in Germany, that's all I know. But I think it would have been neat, and I'm going to suggest this to my church before I fly away, that they might do lessons on these people as for adult Sunday school,
surely,
let alone the children. Now, when I taught the high school class, I did the Old Testament as our stories. The stories of the Old Testament are our stories, and I'm going to teach you our stories so you know them backwards and forwards, because they're our stories. So that's how I taught the Old Testament to our high schoolers, but not other people of the faith.
Well, your idea of having an adult series on faith forbearers who resisted systemic domination, and obviously implicit in
you'll
my
names before I go home.
Okay. Implicit in what I'm saying is that I'm calling the globalizing economy systemic domination. I'm calling it a system of systemic domination, and we'll talk more about that for the next four sessions. But a series at home of in churches based upon forebearers who speak to us today about resistance would be lovely. Yes, you in the green shirt, you had your hand.
Oh, actually, not forebearers, but actual relatives who went to jail for beliefs and spent time because they believed so strongly against the School of the Americas. And so I think, oh yes, that's part of the culture that I'm.
So those are contemporaries, and that speaks to the fact that if we, that our life as Christians must be lived in communities that extend beyond our little communities. Those people are part of our community. Good. Alex and Ben in the blue shirt.
A wonderful resource along those lines is from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which will give to your congregation award-winning video series that have to do with individuals of our past. For example, the one that was very important for us was the history of intolerance in the United States, which spanned 300 or 400 years, but gave individual video segments of some of our resisting forefathers and mothers. And it's free, and it's
I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, good. In fact, let me put a little flag on that comment. One of the things that we're going, well, no, just remember, Alex, that I want to say something about that at the end of the session. Okay, thank you. Now, your name is?
Mary.
Mary, okay.
And I'm a Danish background.
Oh.
And if you remember, in World War II, the Danes were taken over by the Germans, but they received word that they were going to gather up all the Jews and take them to a camp, and they, I think it was like 2 days, they got 2 days notice, and within that time, 7,000 of the 8,000 Jews were taken to Sweden in boats by the Danes, because the Danes thought of the Jews not as Jews, but as Danes first. And there's several, there's one children's story called Bright Candles about two boys that were involved in that. But,
but didn't the King of Denmark also wear a star, and had everyone wear a star so they couldn't tell a Jew from another day?
So there's another example, right, in our own heritage. That's a wonderful example. In fact, I was so interested in studying that I wanted to, that I tried to convince my doctoral committee to let me learn Norwegian or Danish instead of German, because they wouldn't buy it. But it is another part of our heritage to look into what enabled that, you know, to probe what enabled that is fruitful, or could be very fruitful. Let me move us back. How many here are from the Lutheran tradition, or a Lutheran tradition? A few aren't. I hope that those few aren't, don't get too bored. I want to move over to Luther for just a couple of minutes. Because Luther, too, was a resistor. Now, there's a lot of interesting things about Luther that we're not going to look at right here, but one, Luther did stand up and risk his life in the face of a form of systemic domination in his day. Secondly, Luther has economic ethics that, if you read them, just about make your jaw drop. Because he has statements about, because his economic ethics, which are written, believe it or not, many of them are written in his Eucharistic writings about the sacrament of the Eucharist. his economic ethics are fundamentally that economic life is all activity in relationship to neighbor, one. Two, all activity in relationship to neighbor is normed by love thy neighbor as thyself, is normed by neighbor love. So all economic activity has to be normed, guided. The guiding determinant regarding trade and commerce, buying and selling things, is does it serve the well-being of the neighbor, particularly the vulnerable neighbor. That's kind of Luther's economic ethic in a teeny little package with one thing to be added. Also implicit in his economic explicit in his economic ethics is the fact that economic life is also to serve the needs of one's household. So according to Luther, you don't give away it all and lie down and die because you have no food, because you've given it all to the poor. You serve the needs of household and you serve the well-being of the neighbor, particularly the vulnerable. And he comes out with very explicit norms, which we'll talk about later on. Things like you shouldn't sell what the market will bear, or you shouldn't buy up a good cheap and then sell it expensive when there's not a lot there, because then people will suffer. Or there should be ceilings on prices, things like this. Now,
Bush wouldn't be happy.
Well, but it's and you know you can't translate what Luther says about any moral issue straight into contemporary society. There would be no intellectual integrity in that, because Luther said some awful things. Mm-hmm. You know, Luther said horrible things about the Jews, about the Anabaptists. You can't just take his ethics and say, well, right from there we're going to plop him into here. But if you look at what's underneath his economic ethics, that's how you judge the validity of them, and what's underneath them is his firm, consistent theological claim about loving the neighbor. So you've got to take his economic ethics somewhat seriously. And, well, we're not going to go more there, because I want to do more of that later, but that's one of the reasons he's interesting in this discussion. Another reason I think he's interesting in this discussion is because Luther writes things and says things intimately wound into his theology about the presence of the living Christ in us, transforming us into people who love with the love of Christ, not making us morally good, not making us morally perfect, none of that. Never get this mixed up with that we do good and then we're saved, or we do good to get saved. That's completely not Luther. As a result of being made righteous by God, as a result of our salvation, one of the things that happens is Christ comes to live in us and slowly polishes us to become more able to live lives of neighbor love. I want to read to you a couple of his statements. I want to share them with you because I just found them so monumentally startling and hope-giving, and then we'll work from those. Now, maybe y'all have heard this before, and then you won't find it startling, but bear with me if you have. The first of these is this. And the thing is, parenthetically, Luther doesn't just say that Christ lives in us. He also speaks about Christ and God living in all of creation, every bit of creation. Quote, God is flowing and pouring into all creatures, filling all living things. In the Christian, the Holy Spirit inspires new thoughts, creates a new mind and heart. In addition to the grace by which one begins to believe and hold fast to the Word of God, God rules in the believer through God's divine power and agency. Get this. So that the believer constantly grows more and more enlightened, makes daily progress in life and good works, becoming more able to serve people and countries. The Holy Spirit writes a fiery flame on the heart and makes it alive. A new person is made who is conscious of a reason, heart, and mind unlike before. Everything is now alive, and the heart burns with love and delights in whatever pleases God. the Holy Spirit makes the heart burn and creates, get this, new courage, so that the believer grows happy before God and with a happy heart serves the people. Now, do those statements, do they seem startling and powerful to you, or is that just to me? Thoughts, questions, comments? Let me also say that Luther says that God lives in every living thing, even the tiniest leaf. Even the tiniest leaf. Yes. I mean, in our lives. Have you felt that viscerally? Have you felt yourself judging people's worth by economic success?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever walked into a, give me an example. Name some place where that is present, in the back row there.
My name is Steve. My wife works for the big company in Redmond.
Yes.
The mothership.
Yes.
You see that definitely. I mean, we're considered old. She's considered old, and she's 46.
Uh-huh.
And we see this sense of entitlement and power,
uh-huh.
particularly in the people that come there, and that's their first job.
Uh-huh.
More so lately, before the stock started swirling the bowl.
Uh-huh.
But there's definitely a very strong gravitational mm-hmm. pull towards mm-hmm. What you do. Mm-hmm. And what you have is what you are.
Okay.
Without question.
That is actually, one of my methodological claims in looking at all this is that we must decode the myths that make us believe that the economic way permeating the world now is good. And one of those myths is this myth, that those who have been who are most economically successful are the better people. I call that the myth of homo economicos. That and we'll talk about that. The economic men, that we are primarily economic human beings, and our economic success determines our being in success. Those who haven't spoken yet.
Yes. Well, I found that out true quite a while ago. But what really struck me is when my daughter came home, I'd say she was in the third grade and she'd been to someone's home.
Uh-huh.
And I knew of the child from school, and she'd been there, and she goes, "Mommy, what's a mansion?"
Uh-huh.
I said, "Oh, a mansion's a big home." She says, "Well, I went to a mansion today.
Uh-huh.
Amanda lives there.
Uh-huh.
And this house is huge, and her daddy's rich, and how come we're not rich? And I want to help." They learn at an early age about this.
Our church community is in a very wealthy neighborhood in mm-hmm. Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I think we believe in values like you're talking about and mm-hmm. believe in social justice.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, some of our institutions,
mm-hmm.
because they're in this neighborhood, have become very elite, like our school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very hard to get into. A lot of the activities are very expensive,
mm-hmm.
And it's hard to be in that contrast of the wealth and yet the values.
Mm-hmm.
I
couldn't have said that better. You say it's hard to be in that contrast, and you go like this with your hands.
Yeah.
It is hard to be in that contrast. It's the wilderness. I think. There are a number of ways that we cope with that contrast, I think. Move to those for just a minute. What are some of the ways we devise to live with that contrast, the values that cohere with neighbor love, and the reality of living perhaps in a wealthy community where we see, as you said, the elitism, that what the goods that are there are not accessible to people who don't have? What are some of the ways that people devise to live with that?
Rationalize.
Rational? Who
we
said
give
that?
10%.
Wait. Let's just get here this. What did you say, sir?
We rationalize.
Okay, and what do you mean by that?
Well, like Holden Village, for uh-huh. example, there's a lot of people in America who cannot afford to come here.
Uh-huh.
But we rationalize it and say, well, we come here because spiritually enlightened and we're going to take this back. And, but the reality is we're here because we're rich.
Okay. So you said two things. You said two things, and let's not forget them. Listen, folks, the reason this is important is because if we don't demystify why we accept living with the inacceptable, then we'll never get out of it. So you've said two things. You said we rationalize it, we convince ourselves that it maybe is acceptable, and another is, what was the second thing you said?
We're here because we're rich.
But we're not, but if you think this is rich, let me take you to a five-star hotel where one night here is a whole week at Holden.
That's rationalization, though.
Well, I think it's relative.
Go
ahead. No, first let you finish your sentence back here and then up to the upstairs.
I mean, the money we spent here for my family to come here could have fed how many people in Africa?
Okay.
Okay, so one is we rationalize. Very good. We could probe that for the whole day. Okay, Barbara. Pretend that, or decide not to see the extent of the ecological crisis in which we live, for instance. It's very possible that the wars of the next decade will not be wars about oil, but wars about water. Water is now becoming a privatized commodity, sold on the market to those who can pay for it. We people with vast access to information and knowledge tend to not see some of the depth of these crises. So I would suggest that one of the things we do is not really see what's going on. One is rationalize. It seems to me that there's an alternative way to respond to this. You know, you're saying it's hard to live in the contradictions. It seems to me that there is an alternative to either despair and hopelessness or rationalizing or failing to see. Oh, another coping mechanism is often that we just retreat into private morality. I can't deal with the systemic realities. I can't deal with knowing about being a participant in unjust economic realities. I'm just going to be as good as I can in my private life. The best neighbor I can, the best... that is something that I often retreat into, which on the one hand, it's wonderful. On the other hand, it's an incredible lie to say that my life doesn't have political implications. I just wanted to throw that out as another coping mechanism. What I would suggest as another alternative to those coping mechanisms, and it's an alternative made possible only by living in a resurrection faith. It's an alternative that probably isn't possible without living in a resurrection faith. And that is that I'm going to name some things, but not pretend that they're sequential. One of the things is that we commit ourselves to seeing clearly, to becoming more economically and politically literate, seeing clearly the realities around us. Two, that we allow ourselves to lament and grieve and even rage. That we allow ourselves, look at the Psalms of Lament. Think of how much lament there is in Scripture. That we allow ourselves to be deeply, deeply outraged. It seems to me that awe and gratitude and grief and rage will lead the way into more faithful ways of being human in the globalizing economy. Thirdly, that we avail ourselves, that we claim the promises of God. One of which is, and I tried to read that in the Luther quotes, that the God of life and of infinite neighbor love lives in us. You know, to sit with and meditate with that for the next year is availing ourselves of one of the promises of God. Another is that the end of the story is abundant life for all. And that's part of what I mean by saying that this alternative wouldn't be possible without a resurrection faith. The data is not good for the future of the species. The data right now suggests that we're coming to the point where our collision with Earth's natural limits can't be undone. To me, to live in a resurrection faith is part of to live in a resurrection faith is to say, in spite of whatever data, I know the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And let me share a little bit personally of how powerful that has been to me. Then we'll end. As a very young person, I became completely filled with despair about some of the injustices in the world, not to go into details, completely filled with despair, to the point where I think I could have almost taken my life. It seemed so hopeless. And I remember talking with a Lutheran pastor. I went to talk with him in his office, someone in Seattle who had been very active, John Nelson, another John Nelson. I know some of you know John Nelson. Who had been very active who knew some of the brutal realities that I knew, who had seen clearly some realities of injustice. And yet this guy was always filled with laughter. He was laughing all the time. He had adopted 13 kids. He was taking care of them. His wife was always laughing. And there was a spirit of life there that was not a spirit of despair. And I said, John, I need to talk to someone who has seen as much of the reasons for despair as I have, but who hasn't given up. I said, what is it? What is it? And he said to me, he looked at me with this incredible smile. He truly ministered to me, and he said, well, you know, Cindy, I know the end of the story. So, to me, that's one of the promises of faith to which to avail ourselves. If we are going to dare to see the magnitude of the structured enmity in which we live, enmity with many human beings who are foreign, enmity with the earth, to claim that we know the end of this story. And then, you know, after committing ourselves to see and to grieve and lament and to claim the empowering promises, claim the empowering promises of God, then finally to practice, to explore, to further step into living as if. living as if we could manifest neighbor love in our neighbor lives, thinking of the multiple ways to live as if. And one of the things that we will do together, that I'd like to try out doing together in this week, these five sessions, is each day sharing some of that as if living. I'm going to get four big pieces of paper to put on the wall, hopefully we can leave them up, and one of them is just going to be, and four aspects of living as if. One will be lifestyle things, lifestyle changes that come to mind if you and your household were slowly to live more as if you could manifest neighbor love in your economic life. Second will be public witness, ways to do public witness towards economic life as a way of living neighbor love. What are examples of public witness? What might I mean?
Can you tell me what I might mean?
Yes.
Maybe sharing something that you just read.
Okay, sharing.
Particularly illuminating.
Okay. Okay, oh, that's a form of public witness and a lifestyle.
Speak up.
Yes.
Demonstrate.
She said,
recycling. You said going to demonstrations.
Are doing the being in the demonstration.
Okay, okay. Any others related to what I might mean by public witness?
Letters to members of Congress.
Letters to editors.
I'd say live a life. It's not telling, but showing by doing it.
Oh, you mean like St. Francis who said, what did he say?
Preach
the gospel always. When necessary, use words.
Yeah.
That one? Yeah. So one sheet we'll put up is just, will be lifestyle ways. Another will be public witness. Another will be public policy. As you just probe, think, muse about public policy alternatives. My husband has been writing letters to the editor for the last 3 years, and they actually get published. And one of them was asking for certain tax changes anyway, think about taxation issues. Just think about public policy possibilities that would enable more living as if. And we'll talk about some of this also. And finally, on the fourth sheet, we're just going to jot down what comes to you in these days about the experience of, or ways you could nurture, or come to see more clearly, or taste the presence of the living God within us. So I'm going to ask you in these days, just as you go about life in the village, maybe keep a piece of paper in your pocket to jot down notes on things that you would contribute, thoughts and ideas about living as if, in terms of lifestyle, public policy, and public witness, and also hints of, inklings of, tastings of the presence of God within, to enable living towards economic justice as a form of neighbor love. I had thought we would just do a quick preview of the next four sessions, but I think that we need to close because we're already 5 minutes late. Thank you all.